Are you ready for an interview with creative people too? Carolina. It's Carolina Stories.
All right, giddy up. Welcome to Carolina Stories. I am excited for today's episode. I am joined by two guests, and we are primarily going to dive into a company that I find really interesting, Cambria Automobiles in the UK. Before we get into the discussion, just a quick disclaimer. We all own shares of Cambria, but nothing said today should be considered investment advice or a recommendation to buy or sell any security. This is strictly for educational and entertainment purposes only. So with that, I am here with Joe Koster and Alex Bosser. By way of introduction, so Joe runs Sorfus Investments out of Charlotte, North Carolina, and he also runs the blog and newsletter Value Investing World. And then Alex is the founder and portfolio manager at Bossert Capital out of Minneapolis, Minnesota. So before we get into Cambria, Alex, why don't we start with you? Just a little bit of background on your firm and your approach to investing.
Sure. Well, first off, I'm really grateful to be a part of this, Steve. And this is actually the first podcast I've ever done. So I'm really grateful that my first podcast can be with you too. I've known Joe It's been a long time. We've met at Berkshire meetings and other events over the years. So it's good to be together with you, Joe. And Steve, you know, thanks for the invite, and it's good to meet you. Bossert Capital was founded in February of 2017, and I manage money for a select group of wealthy families. We're concentrated, long only, looking globally for really exceptionally mispriced securities. And this company we're talking about today is a perfect example of one of those businesses. So it'll be fun to discuss it in more detail.
Excellent. And Joe, how about you? Can you give us some background on Sorfus?
Yeah, so I launched Sorfus last year, basically run one concentrated strategy, which is obviously similar to why we're talking today, you know, focused on across the market cap scale, but a lot of it in the small and micro cap space. And then also, you know, manage some more diversified portfolios for people who are looking for that. And so, yeah, I think when I met Alex, he was still a teenager, and I wish I would have learned about value investing and been in Omaha the year I met him when I was that young. But yeah, happy to be here.
Great. So Cambria Automobiles, it was founded in 2006 by Mark Lavery. He raised 10.8 million pounds from a private equity firm to pursue a buy and build strategy in the auto dealer space. And it's been wildly successful. So 14 and a half years later, they have 44 dealerships, I believe, currently, about half in the premium and high luxury space, and then the other half are more volume oriented. And they haven't raised a cent of additional equity. So Joe, you actually introduced me to this idea a few years ago. So why don't I kick it over to you? What excites you about Cambria?
Yeah, so I think the longer I'm in this business, the more I get, especially looking at small companies, I learn to appreciate capital allocation. So it's always, you know, you can screen for things that look, you know, cheap on a PE basis or what might have you, even though earnings might not be in vogue these days. Finding companies that, you know, both look cheap but also have a history of capital allocation, as well as, you know, potential runway over the next several years is kind of what interests me most. And, you know, as you mentioned, starting with, you know, from 10.8 million of total capital raised, you know, not issuing it, you know, other equity capital along the way, not diluting shareholders, you know, have been able to grow this into a business, you know, doing over 600 million of sales in a non-COVID year, and producing, you know, more than they'd ever raised to start the company in pre-tax profit now, almost 15 years later. So it's a combination of capital allocation, valuation, and of course having the owner operator with Lavery owning, you know, 40% of the shares himself.
Yep. All great points. Alex, what would you add?
I agree with everything Joe said. It's just, it's been such a unique and interesting business to study. And I had followed Cambria for a few years before I ever bought a share. And the more I study this business and the management team, the more I realize how exceptional they are, both at operating and capital allocation, as Joe hit on. And I actually, I was, you know, almost 2 years ago, went over to the UK and spent 3 weeks visiting every one of Cambria's dealerships. I met with some other companies and was doing other things in the UK too, but it was primarily to visit Cambria. And I met with over 50 people at the company, from, you know, Mark Lavery, the founder, and James Mullins, the CFO, who I think very highly of both of them, all the way down to, you know, mechanics on the shop floor. It was just a fascinating experience to really, the key takeaway was this company has a phenomenal culture, and you can really admire the management team. And it's almost hard to explain, but when you go visit a company, you can just, you know, when a company has an exceptional culture and it's run differently. And I've visited so many companies, and you start to pick up on, you know, okay, this company is run differently than others in the industry. You know, it's run differently, and the results highlight that. They've far outperformed every other company in their sector. As you hit on, 10.8 million pounds of total invested capital, and the market cap is 60 million pounds today. And it's, you know, I think probably worth a lot more than that. So the track record's phenomenal. And that's, you know, that's what I really, the most meaningful factor to me is looking at a company's track record. And that just, you know, you can't fake that. That's just, that is the tangible result. So looking at the track record, looking at the incentives with Mark and the rest of the management team owning a lot of shares, and looking at a result in a year of, you know, this year is a stress test for businesses, for people. I mean, it's, and they've performed well. I mean, their profits declined very slightly, essentially, you know, flat profits year over year in a very tough year. That stands in stark contrast to all their peers. And that's been really interesting to me, to sort of, you know, learn, watch, and observe how they act in a really tough year. So this is an exceptional management team, and you know, what they're doing is very, very unique, and they have a phenomenal track record.
And I think if we can add a little bit to Alex's point, the culture aspect of, and there's the Peter Drucker quote about culture eats strategy for lunch, and you know, this Cambria, from when they started in, you know, 2006, this was kind of a core part of their philosophy, was first to come in, when they first started, was basically buying underperforming asset, you know, dealerships, most losing money in a lot, if not all, of the early cases. And the first thing they did when they came in was sit down with employees and basically go over their plan for, you know, how the Cambria culture is going to work. And I mean, they mentioned it, and I think their annual report every single year, that's one of the first things they do. And with every acquisition they've ever done, and to basically, from the day you start the company, enforce that, so that you're trying to create that culture from the beginning rather than have to recreate it later, I think is an important point to Alex was getting at too.
Yeah, 100%. And one of the things that strikes me reading all of the letters that the company puts out is just this obsessive customer focus. It almost reminds me of Amazon in that respect. And their time horizon is clearly much longer than most car dealers, I would expect, where they are trying to maximize short-term profits, where Cambria is really trying to maximize long-term customer relationships. Any other anecdotes that really hit on culture or management quality that you can point to from your respective interactions with management?
Yeah, well, you're exactly right that they are very customer focused. This year highlights that. Instead of the workshops were not profitable, certainly not, you know, making much of a profit, but likely unprofitable throughout the course of most of this year when, you know, when there were shutdowns and such in the UK. But Mark kept them open because he felt, look, if they've sold a car to somebody, they have an obligation to service that car, even if it's not, even if their workshop is at low utilization, they have an obligation to service their customers, and it does mean something to me to be invested in a company where I can admire the people who run it. They do the right thing for their people, for their customers, and just time and time again, if a company puts their customers first, even when it impacts profits, I found those companies thrive over time. And look, I mean, Cambria's done that time and time again, and they've far outperformed their peers. And so there's no question they're very customer focused, but also they treat their employees really well. And like I said, I've met with over 50 employees there, and I heard so many sort of fascinating stories, and it stands in contrast to their peers, because I've thoroughly studied their peers. They're different, and it shows.
Yep. And then Alex, you also mentioned incentives. So Mark, the founder, CEO, obviously owns 40% of the company. Other incentives that either of you kind of keep tabs on or that you would point to show that minority shareholders are clearly aligned here?
Yeah, well, I would say, kind of Alex, maybe you can talk a little bit about this too, because I learned a lot more about it when you came back and gave me notes, some of the notes on your visit, but the decentralization of basically how they, you know, the different dealerships, the different even departments, they really want the managers to feel like they're running their own business. And I think that, as Buffett always talks about with Berkshire Hathaway and their acquisitions, you know, giving the managers that autonomy to feel like it's their own baby, so to speak, I think makes a big difference in how they've set up their operating structure too.
Yeah, so that's a really good point about the decentralization, which again is unique. So as mentioned, Mark owns 40%, but the rest of the management team owns about another approximately 10%. So there's insider ownership across the management team, and so the directors of each of the dealerships are actually paid. Their incentive structure is based on the monthly profit of their respective dealership. And I think that is just a very intelligent and clever way to do it. It's, you know, it's the underlying profit of their respective dealership at the end of each month. So the incentive structure throughout the organization is very intelligently crafted, in my view.
Yeah, that's a great anecdote. I love it. Let's shift a little bit to business quality. So a lot of people, when they hear auto dealer, they think it's a very cyclical business, probably subpar on the continuum from bad to great business. In your opinion, how would you categorize this on that spectrum?
I think it depends on, since they've started, you can see they've been generating sort of mid-teens, even low 20s at time returns on equity. And I think that's a pretty good business. But, you know, when you're still dealing with the lower profit margin overall business, you've got to manage it well. And So I think it's a decent business, but I think the high luxury segment is a very good business. I mean, these are cars that are, you know, have waiting lists that in times kind of basically get pre-sold before the cars even hit the dealership lots. And so I think it can be good. It can be very sticky, especially the high luxury part of it. But, you know, making your customers happy, you know, is really the thing that matters, because, you know, it's not a software subscription type business, but if you're making your customers happy and they're coming back to you to get a new car every time they need one, and they're coming back to you every time they need service, you almost get this recurring type nature that comes, you know, not in the form of a monthly subscription model, but from the customer not even necessarily going to look elsewhere when it's time for them to get a new car or need new service.
Yeah, to add on to Joe's points, I've followed quite a few auto dealership groups over time, and one I admire a lot is Asbury in the United States, and they produce the best returns on capital in the United States, and it's studying that business over time. When I found Cambria, I saw some of the same attributes. So one attribute that's important to pay attention to at an auto retail business is inventory turns. If you have the best performing auto dealership groups will have faster inventory turns. And so Asbury, as far as I know, has the best inventory turns in the United States. And in the UK, it's of any of the franchise dealers, Cambria's by far has the best inventory turn. So it's, you know, auto retail generally, you know, produces acceptable returns on capital, but nothing, you know, generally not exceptional. But you do have cases where with good management and good positioning, really high returns in capital can be earned. And so with, you know, with Cambria, it's the high inventory turns are a key factor, but also, as Joe mentioned, the focus on high luxury. It's just, it's a different business. I mean, so to touch on that role briefly, a Lamborghini dealership, you're actually, you know, you can only sell a certain number of new Lamborghinis a year. You know, the manufacturer limits the number you can sell. So for Cambria, it's 80 Lamborghinis. So demand is actually probably two or three times higher than that. So this is why it's not cyclical, that particular segment, because even in a slow environment, you know, if demand goes from, you know, three times what you're allowed to sell to two times, you still are selling your 80 Lamborghinis, and the margins are higher. I mean, it's, you know, $20,000 of contribution margin per Lamborghini. And so it's actually a really fantastic business. And Lamborghini only wants to partner with the best operators. So that's an indication that, sort of a proof point of my view of Cambria's exceptional operations is you know, corroborated by these high luxury manufacturers. So it is actually less cyclical. It's higher margin. It's a higher return on capital business. So they're positioned better. They're also better operators, as demonstrated by their inventory turns and their margins overall as well in comparison to peers. So as Joe mentioned, Cambria's earned a high teens, low 20s return on capital over time. That's a pretty, that's a good business. And when you combine that with really, really good capital allocation, this is why in a period that has been actually quite challenging, you know, 2006 to today, I mean, there was the financial crisis and, you know, a double dip recession in the UK, then the Brexit challenges over the last few years, and now the pandemic, and Cambria's thrived in that period, you know. So it's far above average in comparison to their peers, and you know, the operating metrics show that, the you know, the share price in comparison to peers. So it's actually a really wonderful business.
And to add maybe one other point to what Alex was saying, there's also an advantage you get of proving yourself to be a good operator and a good steward of a brand. So, you know, you don't necessarily just get economies of scale of size, which you really don't exist that much in, as far as dealership, but you do get an advantage if you are a proven operator, because, for example, I mean, Cambria in 2018, I think they got two new Lamborghini, two Bentley, and maybe a McLaren dealership that year too, were all basically awarded new greenfield projects that, you know, instead of having to go out, acquire those, you know, pay a premium for those kind of brand names, they were basically awarded those because they'd proven themselves, especially with sort of the Jaguar Land Rover build out that started in 2014. And so by being a good operator, you know, they earn these, which if they do these well, and they have been so far, still in the early stages of building some of those out. But, you know, if there's other dealerships that get in trouble somewhere else and the OEM is looking for a new partner, you know, if you're a proven operator, you come up pretty high in that list.
Yeah, all great points. A few that I want to highlight there. So one, for all auto dealers, people kind of track new car sales, but new car sales just make up, I think it's about 25-30% of gross profit dollars for Cambria. And so used car sales is, call it, another third of the business. And then service is actually 40%, which is much stickier in nature. And then on the high luxury business, in addition to all the points mentioned, I would hypothesize that service retention is actually much higher in those dealerships as well. If you spend a few hundred thousand dollars on a Lamborghini, you're probably not going to bring it to just any mechanic to have it serviced. So from a margin perspective, if the average dealership is kind of in the 1.5% range, give or take, maybe Cambria can operate closer to 2%. How do you think that bifurcates between high luxury versus some of the volume oriented dealerships? So Alex, you mentioned that there was a margin boost. Do you think the high luxury segments are in the 2-3% range? What is your sense?
Yeah,
there?
It varies by brand. So, yeah, for volume, a well-run UK dealership in that segment, 1.5-2% is generally, that's good. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, for example, let's take Ford. Cambria has 5 or 6 Ford dealerships, and 5 of those 6 are in the very top quartile of performance for 4 dealerships in the UK, with margins actually quite a bit above the average Ford dealership in the UK. So Cambria's, so if you sort of do an apples to apples comparison, you know, between, let's say, Cambria's 4 dealerships and Ford dealerships generally in the UK, Cambria's, you know, they're better. They operate them, you know, better on average than peers. So 1.5-2% is reasonable for volume. But again, Cambria's outperforms their peers. So maybe they do a little better than that over time. High luxury is actually quite a bit better, which is why, one of the reasons why this is a better, why it's so intelligent of them to pivot pivot in this direction. So, I mean, 3 or 4% is achievable for a high luxury. I mean, you know, can their Lamborghini dealerships do, you know, 3.5%? I think that is very achievable. So on a blended basis, sort of, you know, when you blend the high luxury and the volume, you know, is Cambria a 2 or 2.5% EBIT margin business? I think that's sort of what it'll look like over time. And what you want to be mindful of is it takes probably 3 to 5 years, probably more like 5 years, for a new dealership or a sort of a refranchised dealership to get to full potential. And the majority of that is building out the customer list in terms of the service in the service department. So as you sell new cars, you make money on the back end with the service. So it takes a while to sort of build that, you know, what they call their car park. So many of Cambria's dealerships are actually not at full potential. Hatfield is only a few years old, and that's a, you know, a major asset to Cambria. So there's margin uplift potential, but you're right. There is a big difference in margins between high luxury and volume.
So on that point, it's such a great point. And Joe made the point earlier that they were awarded, I think it was either 5 or 7 greenfield high luxury dealerships over the past couple of years that aren't at full potential yet. And so in 2019, it looks like they earned about 10 million pounds of net income. Do you have any sense for, on a go forward basis, what that would look like once those greenfield locations are operating at full capacity?
It should be more than 2019. I mean, as Alex was saying, I mean, it takes 3 to 5, usually more like 5, especially with some of these greenfields, to really build out, you know, your customer list and get a full level profitability. And yeah, I mean, I think four of those were 2018 and then 2019. And then of course they bought the two in Scotland earlier this year. I think one Aston, one Rolls Royce, which, you know, basically they bought for roughly NAV, it sounded like. So they didn't pay goodwill, and given their history of turning these things around, I expect they'll be similar to some of their other operations in those brands. Well, in the Aston brand, Rolls is new, but yeah, so I think 2019, obviously 2020 sort of been all thrown into the wind given what's been going on. And obviously part of good chunk of 2021 seems like it's going to be as well. But if you look back at 2018, I mean, there was a lot going on in 2018. They just got these new projects. They were building out a couple of very big build outs. They were still finishing. So exactly what the so-called normalized is going to be, sort of hard to tell at this point because there's still a lot going on and a lot of build out to come. But I think it should be 2019 was a run rate that I think is going to increase from 2019. But if you look at even 2018 at the low, I'm trying to look up, it looks like we had just a little under 8 million in after tax, a little under 8 pence per share in earnings that, you know, it should be miles above that as a normalized basis, giving everything that was going on in 2018. So I don't know if Alex has any more precision than that, but that's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah. Well, what I would say is if you look at the market cap, it's, you know, 60 million pounds. In this last fiscal year, they earned, you know, close to 10 million. That was a year that essentially 1/4 of the year they were completely shut down per government enforced closure of all retail in the UK. And not only that, but, you know, many of their dealerships are not yet at full potential. So in a year where one fourth of the year they were completely shut down, they still earned close to 10 million pounds. And so just imagine in a few years when the pandemic's behind us and they have a normalized year, it's going to look a lot better than this. I don't know exactly how good, but it's certainly going to look a lot better. And I try to be roughly right. And at a certain price, you don't need any precision. I just know it's going to look a lot better, and it's going to be, it's going to be sort of fun to watch the next couple of years, because it's likely going to look a lot better than this period.
Yeah, completely agree. And I don't have precision either. But the way I view it is off of 2019 numbers, it's slightly under 6 times earnings. And then on a normalized basis, maybe closer to 5 times. And in an environment where everybody is trying to find that local business that they can buy for 4 or 5 times earnings and then find a manager to run it, it's sitting in plain sight right here. Not to mention the manager is rolling 40% stake and has an exceptional track record of capital allocation. And it reminds, hearing Alex go through the numbers, it reminds me of that Buffett quote where it's something like, price is my diligence. And I think there is some element of that here as well. But let's shift to capital allocation.
Steve, so, if I could interrupt you for a second. There's actually a massive thing you're missing. And that is, there's 80 to 90 million of freehold land on the balance sheet that's just sitting there. It's being depreciated against earnings every year, even though it's not depreciating. And I can tell you from having visited these dealerships, they're well located in really great areas that, they're all around, primarily around London. And, there's some in Manchester as well, but, it's concentrated around London. Very high quality, well located, they call it high street retail, worth 80 to 90 million. And, you get that thrown in on top of that wonderful earnings yield that you just mentioned.
100%. It's such a great point that I forgot to mention. To me, that provides such downside protection, because that land on the books at cost has probably appreciated, as you mentioned. The other aspect that when people look at the balance sheet, they say, wow, there's all this inventory risk. To me, as an auto retailer, there's not as much risk as one would think, because the OEMs are incentivized to allow that to sell through so that they could then sell more inventory to the auto dealers. And so the OEMs, if inventory is getting stale, will often offer incentives and whatnot to push that inventory. And so it's on their books, but it is in some respects kind of a joint liability with the OEMs.
That's a good point. Yeah, very good point.
So capital allocation, to date, they've been paying a token dividend. And the last time I talked to the CFO, it seemed like that was primarily just to attract some income-oriented investors. And then the bulk of the capital allocation philosophy is just growing organically by buying and developing new dealerships. One could look at this opportunity and say, why in the world aren't they buying into their 44 dealerships at a massive discount to intrinsic value by repurchasing shares? What are your thoughts on that and what are your thoughts generally on the capital allocation capability of the managers?
Yeah, I'll let Alex talk about the repurchases. I think he talked to them a little bit more about that maybe. But for me, the biggest capital allocation positive thing I've seen is their ability to walk away. I mean, they've been in negotiations for a lot of deals and dealerships and to do deals, but if they didn't think the return was going to be there, they just didn't do it. So in the early days, they were, basically just buying these underperforming things where, until they ever paid goodwill, I think they had, you know, so they raised $10.8 million to start. And I think the first time they paid goodwill was Barnett in 2014. And, you know, they had over $4 million, I think, of pre-tax profits in the year leading up to that, you know, before, from basically money losing operations that they had acquired. And then they decide to start paying goodwill, and those acquisitions have worked out very well because, you know, the initial allocations have not only earned decent returns on those businesses, but they've also opened the doors for them to prove themselves to acquiring other things down the road. So, as far as capital allocation, especially the equity, I mean, both to judge them as both operators and investors and as financiers, the three big pools. I mean, they've, in my mind anyway, have been very good on all fronts. Although I would probably prefer them to be buying back some shares at this price as well. But
yeah, this management team is exceptional at capital allocation. Every one of their acquisitions has worked out very well. They've never made a blunder on an acquisition. And one, you know, the most recent acquisition was up in Scotland. It was part of the Levin Group, which went bankrupt, and Mark and James stepped in. And James actually, in his before joining Cambria, did restructurings and bankruptcy workouts and different things. So he had they were actually the only bidder, and James' expertise in this area came has come in really handy. So they were the only bidder. There's two dealerships they bought, an Aston Martin and a Rolls-Royce dealership. They paid probably less, certainly equal or probably less than the value of the land underpinning those dealerships. And they got an Aston Martin and Rolls-Royce franchise essentially for free. So if they closed both those dealerships and just sold the property, they'd show a profit. And so it's exceptional. I mean, that was a smaller acquisition, just a few million dollars. This environment is almost certain to present more opportunities like that. Cambria is both, you know, they're prepared and they're looking for opportunities like what they did earlier this year. And what's interesting is all the pretty much all the larger peers are you know, they're over leveraged or they have operational issues. So not only do those peers not have the capacity to make an acquisition, they're probably actually going to be the ones disposing of dealerships in distress to raise capital. So this is actually going to be a profound opportunity for Cambria. I would not be surprised in the next few years to see them make multiple acquisitions. And if they do make acquisitions, frankly, I don't even need to see the numbers. I know they're making a smart deal. And as Joe mentioned, they passed on a lot of opportunities because they're not exceptional. They're not perfect. And so there will be a lot of distress in this sector, and there are not a lot of natural buyers. And the other thing that people miss is that, you know, the OEM is part of, it works the same way in the US too. They have to approve, the OEM has to approve who buys the dealership. You need buy-in from the OEM. And so it's, you know, Cambria is, you know, they're the natural winner in this environment. It's sort of, you know, the strong get stronger, and Cambria's, you know, Cambria's well positioned, and they could easily pull down a 10, 20, 30, $40 million acquisition. I mean, potentially more. I mean, they're all their properties unencumbered. Some of their properties are, you know, there's a few properties that alone are worth 10 to 20 million pounds. You know, they could sale lease back that property to finance an acquisition. And so what actually really excites me the most with Cambria is just the opportunities that may present themselves in the next few years. So they understand the merits of buying back stock, but they, I think it is the opportunities that are going to present themselves to Cambria in the next year or so are going to be so great that buying back stock at, you know, 50 cents on the dollar, there's going to be even better opportunities than that. And so it's going to be actually really exciting to watch the next few years play out, because they are ready and able to be decisive if opportunity presents itself, which it will.
And I think to add one additional thing to that is it's also still a fairly fragmented market where there's still a lot of mom and pop, so to speak, smaller operators. And I would guess that, you know, I don't have any information on this, but everything with the shutdowns that have gone on this year, that a lot of those smaller dealerships are going to be hurting a lot more once right now they don't have to pay property taxes through the end of March, and the scheme for furloughed workers to help out businesses in the UK. Once all of that has ended, you know, I think you might possibly get some of the consolidation on the smaller end as well.
Yeah, all exceptional points. And I love that philosophy of entering a period of dislocation. There's a lot of opportunity cost to use the capital today to buy into your existing portfolio of 44 dealerships at, call it, 85% of book value, where better opportunities may arise, and being able to have the flexibility to act decisively on those could be pretty interesting. But it also is a good segue into some risks. So as you think, I mean, we kind of laid out the bull case, we talked about why we're excited about it, but as you try to poke holes in your thesis, what are some things here that can go wrong?
Yeah, there's two primary risks that are front and center that are really, really important to consider and think through. So one is the EU-UK trade deal, which, you know, it's you know, there's daily headlines of progress is made or progress is not made. But that has a lot of implications for this sector, because if, you know, to trade on you know, if there is no trade deal, then there would be a 10% tariff on vehicles, and that would be obviously very, very detrimental to the whole sector. So that's you know, it's in nobody's interest to have, it's not in the EU's interest or the UK's interest to have that occur, but that's you know, that is a risk that you know, is a big reason why the shares are trading at such an undemanding multiple. But that's, you know, something to keep in mind. So that's more of a sort of a short term risk, because the current trade arrangement ends the end of this year. So this is sort of, you know, with a very front and center short-term risk. A longer-term risk is the regulation in the UK, which bans internal combustion engines in 2030 and hybrids in 2035. And it's just it's a fact that electric vehicles have far less moving parts, which means there's less to break and go wrong, and which means less opportunity to service those vehicles. And so that is a factor that is actually quite, nobody really knows the answer on how that's going to play out. There's sort of actually, positives and negatives, sort of, there's offsetting factors to that risk too. More complex vehicles mean when something breaks, it costs a lot more to service it, which benefits the revenue of the service department. But net, it's a negative. And that is a new regulation in the UK. That is a very quick timetable to shift to all electric. I mean, that is there's been one primary, engine type for a century, and that's about to change in a very rapid time frame. And what's interesting is Cambria has already pivoted to high luxury, which is again a better position to in this environment as compared to a volume dealer. I think it's actually worth probably avoiding investing in a pure volume dealership. I think the risk is high. And I actually think Cambria is sort of given an earnings multiple commensurate with a volume dealership, but they're not. I mean, the bulk of the value of Cambria is their high luxury segment, which is going to better weather that change. So those are the two. There's other risks to be mindful of, but sort of the two that I spend time thinking about is the trade relationship, but also the impact that electrification will have on the service departments of auto retail.
Yeah, I don't have much to add. I think, as Alex said, I think the biggest risk is hanging there. It's regulatory risk, and it's out in the open, and there's a date on it of now 2030. I think, especially if anyone who's read some of the Horizon Kinetics Q3 stuff about basically how much carbon it takes to try to become a less carbonized world, it seems it's pretty, not impossible, but it seems pretty unrealistic that 2030 number is really going to be physically possible to happen. I think Lavery called it a date without a plan, and that's when that plan starts laying itself out, I think the realities are going to come into view. But the one good thing we can say is we have the biggest predictable risk anyway, and we have a date, so we can sort of say, all right, what's my worst case scenario? In Cambria, pretty much for what could ever be a potential worst case scenario on the EV front, started to invest more and more in its real estate back, well, probably 6 or 7 years ago, maybe. Really, partly sort of the same time they went into high luxury focus, they also wanted to make sure they had the best real estate. They bought some of the properties they were leasing in order to basically have an offset to any worst case scenario. So I think by the time we have that risk where it actually would have a really, really material effect on the business, we'll already earn the market cap in profits. We have that asset portfolio buying it around today that's going to be worth, even if the real estate doesn't appreciate, it's going to be worth more than the market cap today as well. So we basically going to be making our money, again, assuming, as I think all of us do, that we have a team of very good capital allocators and that will continue. That money's not going to just be wasted, but sort of our downside scenario is kind of like a double from basically earnings build up plus real estate value. before this actually becomes a major risk gives you a very good margin of safety, I think, in looking at it today.
Yeah. And Lavery, correct me if I'm wrong, but he's trying to push that 2030 date out to 2050, correct?
Correct. Yeah. Well, yeah, there's been some proposals, but yeah, he's pushing that. Yeah.
Mark always speaks his mind, and he's been lobbying against that. He doesn't feel it's in the best interests of the UK. But what I would say is Cambria has navigated quite a few challenging environments and took advantage of the opportunities presented by those tough environments each time. They've been stress tested multiple times. They, you know, there's been the financial crisis where when multiple peers went bankrupt and it was really a very tough period for the majority of the industry. They took advantage and bought a number of dealerships. I've studied all those acquisitions. They all turned to gold, every one of those acquisitions. And then, you know, there was a double dip in the UK a few years after. They continued to make smart acquisitions and navigate that environment well. There's been Brexit. Again, they navigated it well, and they've maintained a conservative balance sheet the whole time, allowing them to both have a both staying power, but also the ability to be opportunistic. And now, in the pandemic, they've navigated that well. So you have a history of them navigating, not only navigating tough times well, but each time they come out better and stronger every time. And so if, as you look forward, you know, I think you're going to see the same thing. There's going to be challenges, and I have no doubt they will take advantage and make rational decisions. And I don't feel that way about the other auto retail peers in the UK. I think it is going to continue to be the case where Cambria outperforms a peer group that is and those peers are hurt by these changes. That's been the, you know, it's actually really interesting because Cambria and Lookers have been the only two publicly traded auto dealerships in the UK that have made money for their investors in recent times. And now Lookers has run into some serious issues, an accounting restatement being one. So now it's really only Cambria. And so, Cambria has been the only public auto retail business in the UK that's truly earned their investors a strong return over time. And in the years ahead, that the opportunities that Cambria is going to be presented because of the distress that some of their peers is in is, you know, it's a huge opportunity for them. And so I actually look at that as a huge, huge positive. I think, it's just really fun to own a business like this because the surprises are on the upside. I mean, when I first started following Cambria, they didn't own any high luxury dealership. So, you know, I saw them get Lamborghini and then McLaren and then, Bentley and now Rolls Royce is a new addition this year. And, you know, as Joe said, each time they paid no goodwill for those franchises, which is, you know, really remarkable. And so it's fun to own a business where the surprises are are on the upside. And I think it's important to really keep in mind the differences between Cambria and the broader industry. I really see some just really profoundly stark differences between Cambria and the broader peer group. And so I think a lot of people lump that all together, and perhaps that's why Cambria, you know, Cambria trades the same multiple as all their peers when it's, you know, it's sort of a polar difference between them. So that's sort of really, really interesting to me. So it's going to be, you know, it actually the challenges that the are present in the industry with you know, the lockdowns and the government regulations and all and other things is actually a huge opportunity for Cambria. They thrive most in challenging times. I mean, just go back to the financial crisis and look at those acquisitions. They were just incredible. And look at the acquisition earlier this year in Scotland. So challenging times are actually the best times for Cambria. So it'll be really actually really fun to watch the years ahead and see what opportunities they take advantage of during a tumultuous period.
Yeah, such great points. And it all comes back to, for me, having confidence that they'll be able to navigate these risks is underpinned by, one, a conservative balance sheet, and two, an exceptional management team that has 40 or 50% equity interest in the company. So they're 100% aligned with us. So one other risk I would point to, the UK corporate tax rate is at 19%. There's potential that that increases, particularly with the economic turmoil. So the 5 to 6 times multiple we've been talking about may go up to 7-8 times, depending on what that turns out to be. But to Alex's point, all of the competitors would be in even worse situation, and more opportunities would present themselves for Cambria in that scenario. And how about self-driving cars or reduced car ownership due to some of the like Ubers and Lyfts of the world? Does that concern you on a longer time scale?
Eventually, possibly. I think this is where I think the quote you mentioned earlier, the price is my due diligence quote from Buffett, is if I had to decide. So one, I still think it's quite a ways out, by the time it gets a little closer, I think I'll have, you know, basically earned my money and protected my downside at this. By buying it here, but my basic thoughts are a lot of that is still a very, very long way out, and I don't have much advantage in predicting it yet. But price helps me be comfortable with it in this case today.
Yeah, there are risks to be mindful of when investing in Cambria. Self-driving cars are. Just an irrelevant thing to be concerned with. There will not be autonomous driving fleets for a long, long time, if ever. It's almost remarkable how much I hear people talk about that, and it's, you know, it is not in our investable time frame. If it's going to happen ever, it's a long, long way away. It is not a factor to even worry about when investing in Cambria.
Yeah, I agree with that sentiment. The one aspect, I certainly agree that self-driving cars won't be in our investable time horizon. However, it could play into sentiment and therefore multiples. If you see a scenario or a path where it looks like autonomous vehicles will be on the road in 15 or 20 years, obviously that just goes to your cap rate. But yes, all good points. So why don't we shift now to why this opportunity exists? We talked about why we're so excited about it. It's extremely cheap. And so some of the things that have been highlighted throughout the conversation are, one, just the macro headwinds at play here and some of the regulatory issues coming up. Two is just the illiquidity, 60 million pound market cap, and insiders plus the top few holders, I think, own 65-70% of the business. Any other items that you would point to for why this is so cheap?
Yeah, I think those are some big ones. Obviously, I don't think the stock has traded since Thursday, as we talk on a Tuesday. So that certain liquidity, sometimes it comes and there's a little more of it, but it certainly is a big factor, I think, of some people looking at it. But yeah, I mean, regulatory risks and, you know, I think anything, you know, I tend to think, you know, the green energy and all this is going to take a lot more carbon to get there and a lot more time than the transition to a cleaner energy. And I think a lot of that plays a role because people just think we're going to have obviously fewer internal combustion engine cars. I think those are the big things. Obviously, there's diesel sales with a lot of the things going on in the UK and, you know, basically the political stance against them. And, you know, those sales have really dropped off a cliff. So that affects a lot of the new car sales as well. I think some of that has had a difference too. But.
Yeah, I think there's a confluence of factors here. So, you know, as I mentioned, the broader auto peer group, public auto retail businesses in the UK are struggling. I mean, you know, the two largest, Pendragon and Lookers, are both facing, specific issues of their own. You know, Pendragon is, you know, I don't know how to explain it other than to say it's a mess. You know, they have a new leader in there who seems to really be doing the right things, but it's going to take a lot to, it's going to be really tough to turn around that business. And then, you know, the second largest, Lookers, you know, they've actually been delisted because they have been unable to publish accurate financial statements. And they've sort of been, the business has sort of been torn apart by, you know, three auditors now. And they're looking for a new CFO and they, you know, they don't really have strong leadership. So it's easy to understand why, you know, there's some apathy towards this sector in the UK when the largest groups are having some serious problems. Again, you know, their business specific issues in each case. And then you have these, you know, broader concerns as well. The EU-UK trade relationship, that is a very serious factor. So there's a lot of uncertainty there. I mean, nobody, it could be a deal is struck in the next week and all is good, or it could be, you know, a prolonged period where there's no deal and they trade in WTO trade rules. So it's completely uncertain. So there's actually a lot of reasons why I think the broader investment community has complete apathy for UK auto dealerships. And then, you know, if you know, at the same time you have, you know, one gem in the mix here. You have Cambria, the only one that's produced, you know, fantastic returns for investors over you know, the last decade or so. And it trades at sort of the same multiple as the other peers when it's at least my view that they're superior. So there's sort of, you know, broader concerns generally. There's you know, issues with the top two groups that I could imagine turn people off to the sector. And then there's this sort of hidden gem in there that nobody seems to be paying much attention to. But I guess even if you did, a larger fund wouldn't be able to acquire a large stake, as you mentioned. So it's this is actually, you know, the perfect opportunity I like to find, where I can think of all these reasons why a company is hated and or a sector is hated and a company is overlooked within that. And so you actually have, you know, in my view, a big margin of safety because of the property backing. I really love the property backing, because I went to all these dealerships, and they're located in fantastic areas. I mean, you're not going to have a Lamborghini dealership in a tough area. I mean, these are actually very well located properties that, I'm sure other developers would be happy to buy them at a large premium to their book, the historical cost that Cambria bought them at to make condos or retail or something else. So there's a wonderful margin of safety here with that property backing. And at the same time, you have actually really significant upside, because it trades at a cheap multiple, but you also have, you know, a number of their dealerships that have not yet reached full potential. Hatfield is pretty much, you know, it's brand new as of a year or so. And, that has huge potential alone among other dealerships of theirs that are not yet at full potential. And then you have sort of the optionality of acquisitions occurring in a really, a period that's going to present really fantastic opportunities. I would honestly be shocked if we were talking 2 years from now and Cambria had not had some fantastic opportunities they've taken advantage of. I mean, I'd be really surprised. And so there's actually, you know, really fantastic upside here and really solid downside protection as well. And, you know, Mark is a very conservative businessman. He's very careful. He's said no to so many deals. When the pandemic, started to spread across the UK, they were sort of the quickest to shut their operations and furlough staff, and they minimized the losses during that period as a result. And you can sort of compare how they manage the business in the pandemic compared to peers. And again, you'll see, you know, a big difference. And so, I mean, there's some clear reasons to me why it's trading at the price it is. And there's really fantastic downside protection and really significant upside and sort of a path of them, you know, getting there. Like it's just inevitable the years ahead are going to look better than this year. I mean, I think that's a fair statement. We're facing a once in a century pandemic and can really only go up from here. I mean, their operations were shut down for 1/4 of the year. So it's actually going to be really fun to watch the next couple of years. I think there's going to be, you know, earnings growth and revenue growth and opportunities that'll present themselves and maturity of their recently opened or refranchised dealerships. There's just all these actual positive tailwinds that, even if it trades at only 6x earnings forever, that seems unrealistic to me, but, when earnings are likely to grow meaningfully, you'll still have a wonderful result.
Yeah, and Alex. Yeah, I was just going to say, I think you talked to them recently. Is there anything new you learned that maybe Steve and I should know about too?
Yeah, I do have a call with Mark and James quite often, and it's I'm trying to think of anything sort of pivotal that I learned in recent conversations that I didn't know, and I don't think there's anything. It's more I mentioned it before, but it's just it's fun to observe these Mark Lavery and James Mullins run a business through incredibly stressful and tough circumstances, and watch how they navigate that. And it's been actually a really fun learning experience for me to learn from two incredible business managers, and I admire them. And when I talk to employees throughout the organization, it's just so clear to me that they treat their people really well and treat their customers well. And I love observing and watching a business where it's a win-win for all constituents. So it's actually been a really fun educational experience for me to watch two fantastic business managers and how they've outperformed the peer group so significantly. I mean, the first question I asked myself when someone told me about, mentioned Cambria to me, and so I started digging into it, I said, how is this little Cambria Automobiles company so outperform everybody else? What are they doing different? And at this point, it's quite clear to me what they do different. And it's been really fun to observe that and learn from them and study it. And it'll have, a lot of benefits for me in my investing career to sort of help identify other companies that are run exceptionally well and sort of look for similar attributes and signs. And so it's been a really fun educational experience for me to follow this company. I can guarantee you, out in the future, there'll be case studies on this management team. At least there should be, because they're fantastic.
Yeah, one of us will write them. but it brings me to one other point before we close out here. So in the past, I think they've highlighted long-term targets. Maybe it was £1 billion of top line and then 2% operating margins. And I expected they would look to sell the company to one of those larger dealerships when they hit some or they approach some of those milestones. Now it strikes me, given the turmoil that Alex talked about in the marketplace, there's actually a much bigger opportunity for them to grow and build a much bigger business beyond that. Any sense of management's ambition or what do you think the end game is here?
Yeah, the ultimate end game, it's hard to tell now. Yeah, that was always my impression too. I still think the billion in sales and 2% operating margin is something firmly in their mind, probably, in the next 4 or 5 years, maybe even sooner if they're able to do a couple of deals here. But I think long-term, I think what's going to happen in the UK dealer space is you're going to have fewer, bigger dealers offering more services to customers. Cambria has been experimenting with sort of this leasing company they invested in doing, different range of leases. You can do whatever. If you want a car for 1 month, 5 months, there's still not a lot of information I could find out there about it, but it's things like that where I think the dealer model, is going to change, where the services in the past that maybe people would think of, all right, it's the service your car kind of thing, where instead, it's going to be a convenience type thing and different products for leasing or things like that. And a lot of that will be done, I think, among the bigger dealer groups. And so, yes, I don't have any additional insight as far as, what they'll eventually do. But I do think the odds of them maybe going beyond the initial plans as a standalone is a possible scenario.
Yeah, this is this is what I call a jockey bet, where you're betting on the managers, and And I've spent a lot of time with Mark and James, both in person and, you know, frequent calls since then, and I've studied their track record. And you know, as we've been discussing, you know, this is certainly a fantastic management team. If you step back for a moment and if we say, okay, you know, fair value of Cambria is, you know, 100 million pounds today, which I think, you know, the property alone is 80 to 90 million pounds. And so I think, and they produce 10 million of profit in a, you know, like toughest conditions you could imagine. So let's say for a moment they're, you know, this isn't my valuation or anything, but I think I'm making a fair statement that 100 million pounds is probably roughly right. That means they've multiplied their total invested capital by 10 times since their creation in 2006 through a pretty tough period, as mentioned. Now, the next 10 years, my bet that the conditions will probably be easier than a once in a century pandemic and a financial crisis and Brexit and all of that. But in a period where they've had all this, quite a few really challenging broader headwinds, they've multiplied the value of the company by, you know, something like 10 times. Can they do that in the next decade? I think absolutely. I think they're actually, the future is brighter for Cambria than the last 10 years. They've learned a lot. They've gotten better. They have a base to work from. You know, they're more experienced and they have a, Joe touched on this, but they have a phenomenal reputation built, which has a lot of advantages in terms of, you know, getting more greenfield franchises and other benefits as well. So the next 10 years will be brighter for Cambria, even brighter than the last 10 years. The last 10 years of 13 years, I should say, since their founding, 13 or 14 years, it's been pretty fantastic to multiply the value 10x. Mark and James are very ambitious. There's been speculation they'd sell the company at some point. I mean, these guys are young and ambitious. I don't know what they would do if they sold the company. They've got a long runway ahead, and I think they're just getting started. And as long as Mark and James are there, I want to own shares in Cambria to partner with these two fantastic managers. And you know, if you look at the past, it's been pretty pretty successful, and I think they'll replicate that same level of value creation in the future, if not more. So you know, it's hard to say what opportunities are going to present themselves for Cambria, but they are the natural buyer in these distressed situations because they have the capability to turn around a failing dealership. And there's not a lot of other natural buyers for in these distressed situations because their peers are struggling, which is why in the case of the Levin Group, they were the only bidder. I mean, they were the only bidder. It's really remarkable. And you know, they bought a business, two wonderful franchises for just the value of the land underpinning those dealerships. I mean, and there's no competition. I mean, there will be some fantastic opportunities for Cambria in the years ahead. These guys are just getting started and they're very ambitious. And so, the surprises are going to be on the upside.
I love it. And that's a perfect place to leave it. Joe, Alex, this was a blast. Thank you both so much for the time. Just to close out, if folks want to contact you or get in touch with you, where is the best place to reach you online?
My email, just email me, joe@sorfus.com, or I'm on Twitter at JT Koster.
You, feel free to email me at alex@bossertcapital.com. And my last name is spelled B-O-S-S-E-R-T. So alex@bossertcapital.com. Always happy to hear from anyone that wants to discuss stocks or business or anything. So feel free to email me.
It's Carolina Stories.